WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walter Murch is a film editor and sound designer. He's learned that subtle differences can make a big difference in the impact a film has on the viewer. For instance, 25 years ago, for the final scene of The Godfather, when Michael Corleone closes the door on his wife to signify he's now working for the family, Murch recorded all the doors in director Francis Ford Coppola's house, listening for the door slam that would have the sound of betrayal.
That Corleone.
Walter Murch won an Academy Award for his sound design of Apocalypse Now. He also mixed and or edited The Conversation, Julia, Ghost, and Crumb. His new book, The Blink of an Eye, is about film editing. Murch says when it comes to editing conversation, he often paces the cuts according to the rhythm of the character's eye blinks.
This is something I came across almost by accident, a fortuitous accident, when I was editing a film called The Conversation, which came out 25 years or so ago. And Gene Hackman was the star of the film. He was a very accomplished actor. And I noticed that there was a strange alignment between the places that I would choose to cut the film and where the Gene Hackman actor playing this character would blink. Most of the time, an actor just has an involuntary control of when you blink. You're in the moment, and blinking is a very subconscious thing. But it was uncanny that there was this alignment. So I began thinking about it and just started to watch people in ordinary situations blinking. And I began to notice quite soon that there was a very complex, interesting relationship between where people blink and what they're saying, and even more so, what they might be thinking. What you're told in high school biology is that the blink is a device that we have developed to moisten the surface of the eye, and it certainly accomplishes this. But if that were the complete truth, then anyone entering a certain environment would set upon a certain rate of blinking that would remain constant while they were in that environment. In fact, this doesn't happen. You see people who blink repeatedly when they're nervous. You can see people who are enraged who stop blinking entirely. In a strange sense, I found myself able to gauge my own tendency to blink and then somehow reroute that so that I would push the edit button whenever I wanted to blink. And this seemed to produce the most effective places to cut.
How often do you find yourself using that as a technique
all
for pacing? All the time.
All the time. It's a daily thing.
But this is a curious thing. Like, if you're cutting at just the moment, say, I'm ready to blink while watching a scene, would I miss the edit because I was blinking when it happened?
Effectively, you do. And that's one of the things that makes it smooth. If you think about it, film editing is a very violent thing, as I said earlier. It's you're putting people into a situation where they're watching a visual field, which is interesting and complex, and then in a so-called blink of an eye, you remove that entire visual field and replace it with something else. Now, this doesn't represent anything that we have happen to us in our daily lives. If you wake up, and when you wake up in the morning, what you see for the rest of the day is one continuous shot, so to speak. You can turn your head from side to side, but there's all this intervening material in between. So the fact that cutting a film actually works, that people can look at a film and make sense of it, is actually kind of amazing.
Now, Walter Murch, you've also done a lot of sound design for films as well as editing the films.
Yes.
I want to talk with you a little bit about sound. And I know when you're doing a movie, if you just record the real sound of a situation, it sometimes doesn't sound quite right. Mm-hmm. And so you have to fake it. You have to, like, recreate it in a more convincing way. So right. So let's hear some of the ways that you've made sound very convincing, or how you've used sound to create a psychological sure. effect. You've brought some scenes with you. What's the first scene that you brought? What should we listen
first,
for
first
here?
First scene is from the Godfather, and the sound that was recorded for this scene, which is where Michael kills Sollozzo. It's the first time that he's actually...
This is Al Pacino as Michael Corleone.
Al Pacino, right. Who he's acting on behalf of the family, which is something he's tried not to do up to this point. So it's a big turning point for him. The sound that was recorded for this scene was absolutely fine. Francis wanted to hold off on having music. Nonetheless, he wanted something to add a tension to the scene to show what was going on inside Michael. So why don't we listen to the scene, and then I'll talk about what happened.
Great.
Tu basi, sta male. Quandito sta medio. Il cane ti fa un piugnuno. E mettiamo tutto a posto. Sti fissaria, si deve finire.
Okay, Walter Murch, what are you doing
okay.
there?
Well, what you're looking at in that scene is just two people talking in a relatively abandoned restaurant. What you're hearing, especially leading up to the moment that he pulls the trigger, is a very loud sound of an elevated train going around a corner. Nothing in the scene up to this point has indicated that the trains are anywhere in the neighborhood. It takes place in the Bronx in the late 40s, so you're, I guess, allowed to think that such trains would be in the neighborhood, but you haven't seen anything like that. And nothing, visually speaking, allows you to think that anything like that would be so loud if you did hear it. So that you're presented with a equivalency between what you're looking at and what you're hearing, which doesn't quite add up. It's just a close-up of Michael Corleone, and yet there's this loud screeching sound on the track. When something doesn't add up, the mind of the audience is always anxious to make it add up. And if you can find just the right amount of distance between what you see and what you hear, they will incorporate that distance into something that is related to what they're looking at. In this case, that screeching somehow is a reflection of what's going on inside Michael. So in a strange way, people don't hear that screech. What they see instead is a man making up his mind to kill somebody. So in a weird way, that screeching is kind of the neurons in Michael Corleone's mind just before the moment that he says, I will do it.
My guest is film editor and sound designer Walter Murch. His new book on editing is called In the Blink of an Eye. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film sound designer and visual editor Walter Murch. Now, you also did the sound for Apocalypse Now. You worked on the sound for Apocalypse Now. And you've brought a scene from that movie to demonstrate what you did. Maybe you could set up the scene for us.
Okay. This is at the beginning of the film, and the Willard character, who's played by Martin Sheen, is cooped up in a hotel room in Saigon. He's found that there's no place in the world for him other than Vietnam. He's tried to go home. He can't. And yet he's stuck in this hotel room, and they won't give him a mission. They won't let him go out into the jungle. So it's a scene of a man stewing in his own juices. What we're looking at is this images of a man trying to pass the time in a hotel room. What you're going to hear is a transition from the street sounds of Saigon to the sounds of the jungle. So that visually there's a discontinuity again. It's a little bit like the screeching train and Michael Corleone's murder, that they don't quite add up. You're looking at a man in a hotel room, but you're hearing jungle sounds. And so there's a fruitful discontinuity there that allows you to get inside the character's head.
Let's hear it.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm going to wake up back in the jungle, when I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle. I'm here a week now, waiting for a mission, getting softer. Every minute I stay in this room, I get weaker. And every minute Charlie squats in the bush, he gets stronger. Each time I looked around, the walls moved in a little tighter.
Very nice. Now, did you record Martin Sheen's voice also?
Yes, yeah.
What were you looking for? There's a kind of a very interior monologue sound to the way his voice is recorded. I think you probably recorded that differently than if he was actually having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, no, the microphone was, we moved it as close as physically possible to him and then asked him to almost whisper.
Mm-hmm.
So that it gives an interior quality to it, that conventional narration, which has a sort of a documentary film feel, would not have. We wanted at all costs to avoid that and to give you some, some way to get inside the head of this character.
Would it be fair to say that the film you spent the most time editing was Apocalypse Now?
Absolutely, yes. I was a junior partner on that film, and I was editing picture for a year and then worked on the soundtrack for a year. But there were people who'd been on the film for 3 years. Francis, of course, had been on it from the beginning, and that was, I think, 5 years in his case.
How much footage did you have to edit in Apocalypse Now? Can you give us a sense of how many feet or how many hours worth? How about how many hours worth? That would probably be more meaningful.
Well, the film is just under 2.5 hours long, and there were just under 250 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's roughly 100 hours of material for every hour that made it on the screen. So it's actually amazing that we finished it as quickly as we did.
There must have been hundreds of other stories you could have told with that footage. Did you find yourself shaping the story as you were editing?
Yeah. It's there are a few scenes that were shot that are not in the film. Mostly toward the end of the film. But the script, if you can get a hold of the script, the original script, it's actually not that far from the eventual result.
So why was there so much footage?
Partly the technique by which they filmed the battles. They would load up cameras of with a 10-minute load of film and have 8 cameras positioned simultaneously and then simply let loose this gigantic complex machinery of a battle. And it was actually like a battle was taking place in front of your eyes. If you happened to be standing there, you would be less aware of cameras than of there's a battle going on. So it was documentary in a sense. And any documentary has a very large shooting ratio. So there was a high documentary component to Apocalypse Now, where things, fortuitous things would happen and you would capture those things. But in order to increase the your chances of getting something fortuitous, you had to generate a lot of footage to do that.
Could you see the difference between takes? I mean, was it always clear to you which take was the best take?
Well, that's a it's a funny question, because what is good in one context is not good in another. So you have to, when you're putting a film together, you have to both create the context and choose things that will fit into that context. It's a little bit like lifting yourself up by your bootstraps. And that's, if there's a mystery to film editing, it's probably that. You probably put your finger right on it. What is good? And what is good is not always obvious. I wish it were. It would make our life simpler. But things that you look at, that part of you says, oh, that's not very good. Another part of you says, but you know, in this context, it actually might be great. You know, some little... there's a scene a scene where they're briefing Willard on his mission.
In Apocalypse Now.
In Apocalypse Now. And the Harrison Ford character, the trick of that scene was that Francis told the operator to, operator of the camera, to go wherever he wanted, not to be... swayed by whatever anyone was saying. So none of the actors knew when the camera was going to be on them or off them. And there's one scene where Harrison Ford, as an actor, is looking at the camera trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? But the stare that he gives the camera, and he's looking right into the camera at that point, has an unnerving, actually a wonderful effect, which is it reads as a look to Martin Sheen, a look to Willard that says, we're in a very deep situation here, and I have to play this game by the rules, but I hope you have a lot of luck out there, soldier. So you read a tremendous amount into that look, although the look itself was simply Harrison Ford as an actor trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? So, you know, it's one of the rules of film editing, of never have the actors look into the camera. Here, that rule is violated, so it's technically a mistake, but within the context of the scene, which is one of a building up paranoia, it actually fits very well.
Walter Murch, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, you too. Thank you very much, Terry.
Walter Murch's new book is called In the Blink of an Eye, A Perspective on Film Editing. This is Fresh Air.